Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking with you to begin the show about genetic counseling, and we have two guests for you. One is Casey Reiser, the director of the Master of Genetic Counselor Studies Training Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Casey Reiser, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here. Peter Lavoni, and our other guest, is Director of Genetic Counselor Services at UW Health. And Peter, good to have you with us as well.
Wonderful to be here, Larry. Thank you.
As we listen to these two experts talk, I hope you'll join in. Have you had experiences with genetic counseling, for example? What impact has genetic testing maybe had on your health? What would you like to know about what a counselor does? Join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Peter, let's start with you. What are the main responsibilities of a genetic counselor?
Yeah, so genetic counselors work with patients and families to help guide through genetic conditions that may arise in the family. Genetic conditions are exceedingly common. That is, things that we recognize as genetic, but also lots and lots of common conditions have a hereditary component. And there's a lot we can do now to investigate if this may have a hereditary underpinning in a family. And so a genetic counselor can help guide someone through the complexity of, is there something going on in my family? What is that? Is genetic testing of some type going to be helpful? And the complexities of that and the results. And a genetic counselor really works as a guide through that process.
How long have genetic counselors been around? Has this been a long time thing?
Yeah. So, I will ask Casey to weigh in on that, but I will tell you that it's a relatively new profession, but it is roughly 50 years old, with the first training program starting in New York State. But there now are Casey, 50 programs?
There are over 50 programs in North America that are accredited by the American Accreditation or the Accreditation Council of Genetic Counselors. So that's between Canada and the United States. There are genetic counselors and genetic counseling programs internationally as well, but Canada and the U.S. Have the most robust, if you will, training and accreditation and certification. There are some other wonderful programs around the world, but we were sort of the initial folks.
Yeah, and maybe you could, Casey, maybe you could talk about the UW Master of Genetic Counselor Studies training program.
Sure, I'd love to. That's something that I'm very passionate about. The first training program, as Peter said, was Sarah Lawrence in 1969 out in New York. The Wisconsin program was founded. It was one of the first seven, I believe. I was in the third graduating class, so I'm going to date myself, and that was 1980. So I believe the first class was admitted in 76. It's a 21-month training program. Initially, the program started in the Department of Medical Genetics, which was actually sort of it's a funny administrative structure, but both in the College of Ag and Life Sciences and the medical school. It makes sense. Genetics had a lot to do with, or agriculture has a lot to do with genetics. About 2010, due to the leadership within the School of Medicine and Public Health, we became one of the health professions programs within the med school. And so we have been graduating genetic counselors since 1978. and we have grown and continually been accredited. So the leadership and support from the med school and the university system has been tremendous.
What kind of background? I'm thinking about this. I certainly wouldn't qualify, but what kind of background?
Oh, you might be surprised. You might be surprised, Larry. I think the obvious is people who enter a training program have to be well grounded in genetics, which means their undergraduate coursework needs to have that sort of basis. But I always like to talk about two relatively recent grads, one of whom her undergrad degree was in architecture, and another of whom had a graduate degree in medical library science. Now, they certainly had to go back to school before they entered a grad program because they needed to get some of the prereqs done. But we have applicants from all over and with a variety of backgrounds, which is wonderful because you need a variety of perspectives. The other things besides academics for an individual is we need them to understand what a genetic counselor does, that someone where relational work and relationships with patients and families is what they're looking for, is sort of at the core of what they do. Even, and I'm sure Peter will mention later about the variety of things that genetic counselors can do once they leave a training program, whether it's working in industry or in laboratory, at the core of what they think about has to be what's best for the patient and the family. And so we look for that sort of person.
So I'm a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication within CALS, and the first thing that I thought of was good communication skills.
Yes. We recently had a student who had a dual degree as an undergrad that was in genetics and genomics and life sciences communication. It was a wonderful sort of combination for him.
So what are the requirements for becoming licensed then? Is it passing or, you know, successfully completing this program or?
Those states that have licensure, Wisconsin is not one of them. I think Peter can talk a bit more about where we're at in that process. But those states that have licensure, it is tied to graduation from an accredited program, and there is a national certification exam that's given by the American Board of Genetic Counselors. And you have to pass that and keep up with your certification. So Peter,
do you want to add on there?
Yeah. So, yeah, the national board certification is an important step for genetic counselors to be able to demonstrate their expertise. As Casey mentioned, most states now also license genetic counselors. And, this is me injecting a little bit of opinion, but I am hoping that we get to that point here in Wisconsin, because as I'm sure we're going to talk about, Larry, some of the tools that we have available to help patients, families, communities in Wisconsin are pretty powerful and can be wonderful tools when applied correctly. But if they're not being applied correctly, they're potentially dangerous. And I think that having licensure does allow the public to recognize, you know, that sort of state sanctioning of, we believe this person is qualified to do this.
Let's give our audience a chance to join in. Questions for our two guests today, Peter Livonian, Director of Genetic Counselor Services at UW Health, and Casey Reiser, the Director of the Master of Genetic Counselor Studies training program at UW-Madison. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Questions, experiences to share, we'd love to hear from you. In fact, Mike in Milton emailed, when his son was born in 2003, they found out shortly after that he had a metabolic condition that he and his wife genetically passed, that Mike and his wife genetically passed on to the son. At the UW Metabolic Clinic, they were advised if they had more children, they might have that condition as well. This was the factor in their son being their only child. He's a healthy teenager now, able to manage his condition himself. Comment on that.
Thank you for sharing that. And it's wonderful that he received care that made a difference in his life. Actually, I was hoping someone would bring up newborn screening, because if I'm remembering correctly, he said that's how his son was identified as having a metabolic condition. And that is probably, it's one of the best examples of genetics and public health working together. I can't remember how many disorders now are on newborn screen. For people who are listening, newborn screening is a process where all newborns are tested for diseases that, if identified, there can be early intervention that prevents or minimizes the consequence. And newborn screening is a success story in that realm.
Great. Mike, thank you so much for that question. And some callers coming in. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Taking a look at genetic counseling and your health care with our two guests, Peter Livonian and Casey Reiser of the University of Wisconsin. Well, maybe let's take another call here. John in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, I wondered what their opinion would be on finding out if your children carry the same disorder that a parent might. I have factor V Leiden, and I did have a pulmonary embolism already. And I've asked my general practitioner about finding this out for my kids, and they just, like, don't think it's, well, necessary.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you can comment on this, but also I'm wondering, is this a role that a genetic counselor might play in talking with someone?
Yeah, that is issues like this this condition involving genetic underpinnings to blood clotting, like this the caller mentions factor V Leiden. This is the predisposition to clotting is a complex process that involves multiple genes, actually. Factor V Leiden is one of those. And occasionally, genetic testing is helpful in families to figure out who has inherited certain factors. And this is one of those times where, exactly, a genetic counselor could be helpful in trying to figure out, should we be testing for factor V Leiden in the family? And should we only be testing for factor V Leiden, or should we be looking at other clotting factors as well? So those kind of complex, nuanced conversations are good ones to have. And you know, I applaud the caller for, you know, continuing to ask the primary care provider about that. And they may ultimately decide that it's best to refer to a genetic counselor in the Milwaukee area to address it specifically.
Yeah, so, and that's something John, for example, could ask his doctor for a referral, I would think.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. So there you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Peter Lavonian and Casey Reiser, our guests today. Our engineer today is Trina LaSousa, and our producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here looking at genetic counseling and your health care. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along today. Maybe genetic counseling has helped you decide on health care treatment. Or maybe you just have questions about the counseling itself and what a counselor might do. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Peter John's question to us brought to mind, at least a question in my mind, when and how does a patient get assigned a genetic counselor? In your case, you know, you were suggesting maybe the person should ask, John should be asking his primary for a referral, but typically, when and how does a patient get assigned?
Yeah. So, you know, this is a really important question is, you know, how would somebody get from, you know, point A to point B, to having a question, to actually getting in to see someone? And, you know, the traditional method is that a person's primary care provider or specialty care provider might recognize certain features that might be an indicator that someone might need to see a genetic counselor. So from my clinical specialty area of cancer genetics, for example, if somebody had multiple relatives with certain types of cancers, and if those cancers were occurring at younger than expected ages, an astute clinician might say, I'm concerned that this might be a hereditary pattern in your family. Let me refer you to a genetic counselor. And then, you know, any provider in their community will know how to access genetic counselors. But very often these days, thanks to the internet and other factors, a lot of this is patient driven. Patients are showing up in their provider's offices and saying, hey, I would like a referral to a genetic counselor because I've noticed this pattern of early age heart disease or this neurological condition in my family or pattern of cancer and so on.
And I'm wondering, are genetic counselors, is this covered kind of thing covered under typical medical insurance?
Yeah, most insurance covers genetic counseling. Almost all insurance covers genetic testing, if that's something that is ultimately recommended.
Let's give Mary in La Crosse a chance to join in. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. And I hope you'll give me a minute because I have two stories of the importance of genetic counseling. My husband had alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency was, after an accident, was noticed that his lungs were destroyed. He was tested and was as easy. And so my daughter and I went to the genetic counselor here in La Crosse, had the testing, and fortunately, I don't carry that gene, but my kids do. I was orphaned at three, and all I knew about my biological family, I was adopted by a family down the street, so I knew a little about them. In my genetic family, my father and his mother died of stomach cancer, and my son a couple of months ago was having a physical, and they noticed on his record he had put that down. And so he did the short genetic testing and discovered that he carries a gene Lynch for Lynch syndrome for stomach and colon cancer. And so it is so important to have this genetic testing done. And I'm going to do the complete one now. He did a short one to see what else I might carry to pass on. Because if in my husband's family we had known about Alpha 1, he would not have smoked. We would have not heated with wood. My kids now know what to stay away from. And we also know now the importance of doing the colonoscopy.
Wow.
Genetic testing is, I think, it's one of the most important things we can do for our children and our family.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mary, for calling and for sharing those stories. Casey, a comment from you on this.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, because those are perfect examples of thinking about it from a preventative perspective, because now that they know those diagnoses are in their family, they know what kind of screening is important. And early screening for cancer, certainly Peter can speak to that much, much better, are vital for care. I think also in terms of the alpha-1 antitrypsin, that adds a whole nother layer when we think about knowing behavioral lifestyle changes that we can do, whether it's, you know, not smoking or making sure one exercises. And behavioral changes are hard to make to begin with, but now there's added evidence, if you will, within this family, how very important that is. And I think that's going to be one of the bigger important areas for genetic testing to participate in when we talk about complex diseases like diabetes and heart disease and et cetera. And yes, that can get very complicated, but it's so important.
Mary, I really appreciate your calling and sharing that with us. Kathleen in Beaver Dam, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I was listening, and you were talking about the tests that all babies get. And I just wanted to say that my son, about 34 years ago, was born, and he was tested. And then we were told that he had PKU. And we were kind of referred immediately to the Weissman Center, where they explained it to two very worried parents. And I just wanted to let you know that he's 34, and he's a sales manager for a company, and I'm very proud of him, and I so appreciated those tests being done on him.
Oh, thanks, Kathleen. What can you say to that, Peter?
I think it's another wonderful story that shows the power, the potential power of genetics. I mean, this is a young man, a healthy young man who, you know, is in that state because of newborn screening. That's a fantastic story, Kathleen.
Yeah.
Can I add something?
Yeah, go right ahead, Casey.
I think one of the things that is maybe implied, but knowing that he is a healthy young man now, successful, but prior to newborn screening, if his diagnosis hadn't been recognized in the newborn period, he would now be in a very different state in terms of what his cognitive ability would be, where his ability to live independently, his ability to do the things that you and I take for granted. And it's only because of newborn screening and because of the special diet that the folks at the Weissman Center were able to help them manage is why he's where he's at today. And the, you know, hundreds of other children who've been identified since then, I honestly don't know those numbers, but it has a huge impact
on the rest of their life, for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, again, Kathleen, thank you. I want to give Louise in Dodgeville a chance to join in. Louise, what's on your mind?
Actually, I have two questions. One, with genetic testing, if insurance pays for it, if you have a gene and subsequently get a disease, does the insurance think of it as like a pre-existing condition? And then I guess, what are the statistics on genes expressing themselves? Like, if you have said gene, is it 100% guaranteed that you're going to get said disease, or how does that kind of factor in?
Oh, good questions. Thanks very much, Louise, for calling. Well, Peter, start with you.
Yeah. So these are both great questions. And the second question first, the kind of nerdy genetic term there that we use for what you're describing is called penetrance. So we may inherit a gene that is not working properly, but we don't 100% of the time, in many cases, see a manifestation of the genetic condition from that. If we do, if you have the gene alteration or mutation, and we always see a disease develop because of that, we would call that 100% penetrant or fully penetrant. But we know that there are many conditions where that's not the case. There was a caller earlier who made a reference to a condition called Lynch syndrome. This was a very important condition for their family to know about, because a person with who inherits a gene for Lynch syndrome has about a 60% chance to develop colon cancer in their lifetime. That's much, much higher than the average person's risk. And that's why we need to identify it to do the interventions earlier. But it's not a 100% risk. And so this issue of penetrance is something that we always have to discuss with patients. So that's a great question. And if I may continue to the other question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Ask is one that we get asked frequently about, well, what if, even if my insurance covers this, will this create some challenges for me? You know, if my insurance company knows about a genetic change in a gene that causes a condition that might develop later in life, develop in adulthood, will this create problems for me? Will they drop me from my health insurance? Will they charge me more? And the good news is that there are legislative protections at the state level and federal level to help prevent that kind of abuse on the part of a health insurance company. And in fact, Wisconsin was one of the earliest states to adopt some anti-genetic discrimination laws back in the kind of early to mid-90s, which was very forward-thinking. But there are also some laws at the federal level that also prohibit health insurance companies from charging someone more because of genetic changes or dropping someone from coverage because of genetic changes. So it's nice that those protections are out there, because this is powerful information. People should be able to use it without fear of losing their insurance.
Good points. Louise, those were great questions as well. Well, they've all been great questions and comments today. Ginger emailed. She wanted to know about difficulty obtaining funding for these services through insurance, which you say most insurance companies do handle. Wondered also, though, about public funding like Medicaid, if it's available through something public like Medicaid. Are most people able to access these services, I guess we could say?
Do you want to take this? I will say
not
that
really, Peter.
Exactly. The public funded insurances like Medicaid, Medicare. These are challenges for us because in the example of Medicare, Medicare does not cover genetic counseling. They cover genetic testing, but Medicare does not cover genetic counseling. Now, most institutions, like here at UW Health, we have ways of working with patients who need genetic counseling services, who have Medicare. There are ways to make this affordable and accessible. But this is a really good question, Ginger. We have to always be thinking about the equity in these things because we don't want genetic services to only be available to those who have insurance who can cover it.
Yeah.
I think, and this is just answering from my decades of experience in working in the pediatric population, both here and then also in Michigan, I find that we do a really pretty good job of taking care of children and doing what we need to for children in healthcare. We do not a great job of when children age out of services and systems. And I think that's where there are some real gaps, certainly in taking care of individuals with genetic conditions as they move to adulthood.
Pam in New Berlin will give you a chance. Hi, Pam. I think we may have lost Pam. Casey, I did want to ask you, I assume with the program, the Genetic Counselor Studies training program, obviously students in that program at some point must have to have patient experience as part of that whole thing. And I imagine that is provided through that.
Absolutely. When a program is accredited, the accreditation has strict requirements in terms of content. And the content obviously includes didactic courses and lectures and not lectures, didactic courses that include a counseling orientation, a science orientation, but you have to be able to put that into practice. And currently that training not only involves the coursework, but it also involves clinical rotations or field work, as we call it. And so our students will leave with having spent time in oncology clinics and prenatal clinics and pediatric clinics and specialty clinics. Most of our clinics are within the UW Health system because they have such a broad base for us. So,
yeah, and this is why Casey and I partner so well, is that she's training the next generation of genetic counselors, but I have an amazing team of expert genetic counselors in multiple clinics that can help train those students. So it's a great partnership.
And do counselors, someone wondered, do counselors continue to consult with patients even after they're discharged, perhaps?
Well,
it depends, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, when I think of discharge, I think of inpatient services, but outpatient services is primarily what we do. And when I think about that, regardless of what realm you're in, what specialty, often you maintain contact with families for years. For example, if I worked in a bone dysplasia clinic, a skeletal dysplasia clinic, where we primarily saw individuals with dwarfing disorders. And I often tell students that I have received birth announcements. I've received graduation announcements. I've been invited to weddings, and sadly, I've attended some funerals. But really, because most genetic conditions are lifelong, they may be involved with someone either during that entire time or at times of transition. For example, I work in a pediatric clinic, and initially when a baby is born and diagnosed with a condition, my conversations are with their parents about either recurrence risks or what do you need to think about for monitoring and surveillance. But after a while, my conversations turn to the teenager as they approach adulthood. And what is it that they need to know about their condition to manage it for themselves once they're no longer, once they're independent? And what do they need to know about genetic implications? And I want to make sure to say that genetic counselors work as part of a team. We are not, we don't manage the conditions or treat the conditions, but we are part of that team and can have those conversations to say, you need to make sure that you consult with your nephrologist or you consult with your oncologist or what have you. And these are the kinds of questions you ask. So that's kind of a long answer in that it varies at whatever transition point someone may be at.
Someone else wondered, why is there much of a market for genetic counselors? I mean, if you once you graduate, are there?
Oh, you will be employed. You will be employed. Our graduates, and I don't think this is any different for any other training program. They're all employed within 6 weeks of graduation, as long as they're looking for a job. And many of them are employed before graduation. That's not a concern, whether it will be in the area they want to stay in, but that's also a bit easier these days than when I graduated. But the market is good.
And how do people find out more about the training program itself? Is there certainly online presence?
Absolutely. We have an online presence, our training program through the School of Medicine and Public Health. If you just go to even the UW, University of Wisconsin website and type in genetic counseling program, we will come up. The Accreditation Council for Genetic Counseling has a list of available programs, and they can, it's gceducation.org, I believe. The National Society of Genetic Counselors is a wonderful resource, and that's nsgc.org. So there are
lots of ways,
lots of places one can go to find available training programs. There's also one last plug, and that's the Wisconsin Genetic Counselor. What's the name, Peter?
Wisconsin Genetic Counselor Alliance.
Okay.
There we go.
WICGA. And they have a lot of information for people who are interested in learning more as a profession. And I will say there is another training program in Wisconsin. So for people who also has available information, and that's out of the Medical College of Wisconsin.
There we go. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with both of you today. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us to talk about the program. I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was our pleasure, Larry.
The time flies. Peter Livonian is Director of Genetic Counselor Services at UW Health. Casey Reiser, Director of the Master of Genetic Counselor Studies Training Program at the UW Madison. We'll get them back sometime. Sorry we didn't get to all the questions, but we will do that down the road. I'm going to switch gears and really talk with you about something a bit different. The pandemic has really shone the spotlight on our education system, and our next guest thinks we ought to rethink some of the things that we've been teaching and doing with our kids. That next. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to the Ideas Network.